I asked Frederick, who I met in Malibu, to come and share his story with us. And he brought his great big smile with him, and he's here. So I'm turning the meeting over to Frederick. Thank you so much for coming to share your story.
Donnie, thank you so much for asking me to come. My name is Frederick. I'm an alcoholic, and it's good to see you guys. Good to be here. And are you guys all over the country? Are you in the same place or general area? I just wasn't sure if you guys were on the East Coast or West Coast.
We are global.
Global. Okay, awesome. Well, I'm glad to be in this global community with you guys tonight. I am Frederick. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 13th, 2006. So I celebrated 18 years of sobriety about 3.5 weeks ago, like 3 weeks ago Wednesday, which I'm truly, 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 truly grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for my life, for my sobriety. I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous via a treatment center. I live in Los Angeles, California, so I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous via a treatment center in Glendale, California. And I found out about this treatment center because about 3 months or so before I got sober, I thought I might have, I didn't know what my problem was, but I thought something was going on. And I never said to myself, I'm an alcoholic. I just knew like I was in a bad way. And I had just got a new job. And right before I got this new job, I was on a temp assignment, and this is like November 05. I was on a temp assignment, and I was going into this temp assignment hungover every day, to the point that like people were saying something about my appearance when I walked into the office. So it's kind of like I wasn't cleaning up how I used to clean up and be able to kind of maybe like pass for sober or pass for normal or whatever it was. And so I remember I was on this temp assignment, and I looked in the yellow pages in the phone book. There was a phone book there, and something told me to look in this phone book. And I looked in A at the beginning of the phone book, and I saw the name of this therapist, and it was under alcohol and addiction therapist specialist or something like that. And I called this guy. So I'm on a temp assignment. I'm speaking in like hushed tones in my cubicle. I'm not in a private office. But I called this guy and I said, I think I might have a problem. And he said, okay, I'm going to fax you some paperwork, and I want you to fill these things out and get it back to me. So he faxed me this stuff on this temp job. And I'm sitting there, and it was kind of it was a questionnaire about alcohol use and substance use. And it was like yes or no, short answer, true or false, that kind of thing. And so I filled out all this information and I sent it back to him. And I called him like the next day or the day afterward, still from that temp job. And he told me, he said, Mr. Johnson, he said, you could come to me for therapy twice a week, but I don't want to waste your money. He said, based on how you've answered this material, I really think you need to be in a facility. And he gave me the name and number of this intake coordinator at a facility. And you guys, that was like November 05. And so my attitude when I got off the phone with him was like, you know, see, I tried to get help. You know, like now I got to call somebody. Like he was sending me on a wild goose chase, you know, like I was going to have to jump through some other hoop now. But I never threw that phone number away. I never threw that phone number away. And that temp assignment ended. And I started a new job. It was a miracle because I was really struggling to get employment the last 3 years before I came into the program. And I didn't understand why. So I had these little temp jobs and side jobs and under the table jobs, but I wasn't employable in the way that I had been in the past, where I was able to kind of get a decent job. And I wasn't connecting the dots as to what that could be about. And so a woman who I used to work for several years before emailed me and said, hey, we need somebody over at this company. Are you looking? So I kind of went from like, I already knew the temp job was coming to an end. So I just jumped into this new situation. And I told myself, I said that I basically said, this time it's going to be different. And I started that job because I thought, oh, I've got another chance. And I started that job the week of Thanksgiving 2005. And I was not, I was gonna, this time was gonna be different. And it wasn't long before. And at that point, I was already a morning drinker. At that point, I was having a drink before I went to work. I had a cup in my car between the seats that like when I was driving, when the car wasn't broken down, because it was one of those cars that it was always breaking down and fixing and breaking down and fixing and breaking down. But I would have a cup in between the seats, and I would just leave the cup there all day. I'd be in the temp job and I'd come out. It didn't matter that the liquor was warm. It didn't matter. It was just like, that's kind of where I was with needing to have a drink before I even showed up at a job. And so I thought I could pull this off, and it wasn't long before I was just doing what I normally do. And 3 months later, I ended up going to treatment. I ended up going to treatment on March 13th, 2006, which is my sobriety date. And I got introduced to AA there. My very first night of sobriety, I called that number. Oh, the whole point of that story was, is I called the number of the intake guy that he gave me. So when I had my moment of clarity and I called my sister, who I reached out to for help, she said, "Oh, I'm going to get online. I'm going to find a place. I'm going to find something." And that was on Sunday night, March 12th. And I had not thought, you guys, I had not thought about that phone number. I had not thought about calling that therapist out of the phone book. I had not thought about that at all. It had been 3 months before, 3.5 months. I hadn't thought about it. As soon as my sister said that, this thought came to me, and I said, "Wait, I think I know a place." And I was living in a hovel. I was living in a place that just looked like someone that had lost the will to care, to take care of themselves, that was an alcoholic that just, whose life was crumbling, had crumbled. That's what this little apartment looked like. And I found that number. I put her on hold, and within, I don't even think it took me 2 minutes to find it. Somehow I found that number, and I said, "I've got a place." And she picked me up the next morning. And I'll tell you guys, that night after I got off the phone with her, it was about 9:30 p.m. I know I'm going to this treatment center. I don't even know what sobriety is. I don't even ever think in my mind, I'm not going to drink the next day. I'm not thinking any of that. I just remember crying myself to sleep that night. And you guys know that what I call that exorcism cry, where you're shuddering and shaking and crying and the snot's coming out of your nose and all of that stuff. Like, I cried myself to sleep that night because I was just so, I had this thought that maybe I might just get off this merry-go-round that had become my life, which had become this torturous nightmare of a way of living, that I was a trap I just could not get out of. And just the fact that somebody was coming for me, that help was on the way, that my sister was coming, and I slept like peacefully for the first time, and I don't even know how long. And the next morning I got up, she picked me up first thing that morning. I went to the treat She took me to that treatment center in Glendale. The guy whose phone number I was given, the intake guy, was sitting right there at the front desk. He was sitting right there. And I was like, "I got your number from so and so." And I didn't have insurance, health insurance, medical insurance. I didn't have, my sister paid an amount to get me in that day. So I just kind of went in. We didn't pack a bag. I thought we were going to go talk to somebody. Like, I didn't know. I was literally like going inside after that conversation. I was going in. And my very first night sober, I was sitting in this room, one of the group rooms, in a semicircle with like 8 or 10 people. And these three people came in from the Hospitals and Institution Committee of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I didn't know what that was. I didn't know who they were. But these three people came in, and I was absolutely shocked. It was two men and a woman. And I remember one of the men, but it was the woman. I was shocked that this woman told my story, who was sitting before me. And she told my story in how she drank and how she thought and how she felt, some of her behaviors. And I was stunned. And because she didn't, she looked like a normal person. Like, she looked all cleaned up. And she said she was sober for 4 years as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know even what that meant. Somebody saying that, what I translated that in my mind was, you used to be living exactly in this fashion I am right now, and you're not anymore. And something happened to you to make that possible. I didn't even know it was continuous sobriety she was talking about. Like, it was just way too sophisticated for me to wrap my mind around. But she gave me a hope that there was a possibility that maybe, just maybe, there might be something to what she was talking about, you know? And that, coupled with the fact that I really just no longer wanted to live how I was living. Like, for the first time in my life, I was just sick enough of myself to try to do something another way other than the one that I was coming up with. Because that was always my, even I would go to the experts and say, "Expert, can you help me do this?" And they'd say, "Frederick, you'd be successful if you did X, Y, and Z." And I'd leave the expert and say, "You know, I don't know. I think I'm going to do it this other way I was thinking about." You know, like, I did not follow what other people said. But for some reason, you know, and I think I know what the reason is, you know, all it, you know, there's a line in the book, and we, in the chapter, We Agnostics, that says alcohol was the great persuader, and that faced with alcoholic destruction, we become more open-minded, you know. And so I think I had come to a point where alcohol had done enough of a job on me, and I was persuaded, and I would faced alcoholic destruction, and there was the thought that, like, you know, that is what was propelling me to be willing to do what strangers I didn't even know at a treatment center in Glendale, California, were asking me to do, when I really wasn't one to follow what people were telling me. Like, I was compliant. I was the kind of person that knew how to be compliant, you know, if you told me to do something, because I wanted to get what I wanted out of it. So I would comply in terms of, like, whatever I was trying to get out of it, whatever the ends of the means were for me. But this was really about surrender. Like, it wasn't about compliance. It was really, I had never come to a place in my life where, without any guarantees, without knowing how much money I was going to get, without knowing what the outcome was going to be, that I was really just surrendering and trusting in something that I wasn't even certain what it was. And the only reason why is because I was persuaded by the alcoholic destruction that I've been brought to, that I just thought, I just don't want to go back. I don't know where forward is necessarily, but I don't want to go back to the nightmare I've just escaped. So that's how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, certainly that's not the path I thought my life was going to take. You know, my earliest childhood memories are of my mother, in her alcoholism. My mother was an alcoholic who raised me the first 4 years of my life, 3.5 years of my life. And I have vivid memories of her being passed out, you know, of her. We lived on the, there was a liquor store on the corner of the street we lived. And then there was an alleyway next to the liquor store. And then there was this little green house that was the first house. And that was the house we lived in. And so I and my father, they my parents were already in a divorce process at the point of me remembering. And so I never remember my parents living together. But I can tell you, I do remember just being placed in front of a television while my mother went next door to the liquor store, because you and she sat on the side of the liquor store with those other alcoholics. And that's what they did. You know, they sat on these crates on the side of the liquor store, and they drank all day. And you could see right outside of our kitchen window the side of the liquor store. So that was like, it was almost kind of like, oh, I'm not going far. I'm right next door here at the liquor store. I can just sit this child here in front of the television. He'll be okay. But, you know, I was living with an alcoholic who had to get to the next drink. You know, and it's interesting because my first resentment, when I later discovered, when I got into the program and got into the 12 steps, my first resentment was against my mother. And I like, and I remember when I heard somebody in AA say, when I was new, my parent that was an alcoholic, I said, I'll never be like them. Like, that was what I said. I was never, I tried to distance myself from my mother I try to distance myself from all of the embarrassment and the shame and the association. I had a stepmother that my father married when I was 4, and I said, "Oh, that's my mother, my stepmother." Like, I really tried to distance myself because I was like, I was never going to be like her, and I ended up just like her. I ended up just like her. So I didn't know then what I know now, which is, when you are powerless over alcohol, you cannot show up. And it would have been nice. And I know from my own experience, for all the people I was not able to show up for, I would have if I could have, but I took a drink and the drink took me, So I had resentment going on before I had a first drink that I wasn't even aware of, By the time I had the first experience with alcohol, which I was a young teenager hanging out with older cousins that were like college age, and I thought I was cool. So this was a whole, I want to be cool, I'm cool, I'm 14, they're 19, I'm hanging out with them, and I just wanted to do what they did. And they drank Crown Royal. You guys remember Crown Royal with the purple velvety bag and the gold trim bottle? It was a very attractive bottle. And that's what they drank. So obviously my first drink was a sophisticated drink. It was Crown Royal. I didn't even know what it was. But the last drink was whatever pennies, nickels, and dimes and loose change can get you at the liquor store when you're counting it out on the counter at 6 o'clock in the morning. Whatever that ended up being, that was the last drink. But Crown Royal as a first drink, I didn't even know what I was drinking. I knew it was dark liquor. But I wanted to act like I knew what I was doing. And it was a night we were going to the movies. We were going to see Twins with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito. Remember Twins? We were going to see Twins. And I'll never forget when it came back to the back seat, because they would just drive and pass the bottle around and one's packed in the car. And it came to the back seat and I thought, I want to try this. I want to try this. And I took it back and it was strong. It did not taste great. It was nasty, but I tried to act like I knew what I was doing. And then it came down, and then, it kind of had that burning in my throat. And then it hit that spot. Then there was this like explosion in my chest when it hit that spot. And it was like, once I got past that, what I do remember, I vividly remember this whole feeling of it changed the way that I felt. I didn't have the language that I got, when I came to AA. It made sense. Like when you guys talked about being restless, irritable, and discontented, and then finding ease and comfort from that through alcohol, it made sense. I just didn't know that's what was happening. I remember being in treatment when you're hearing all the lingo of recovery and all that stuff, and I would hear people talk about restless, irritable, and discontented, and I would think to myself, I never had the words, but I was like, that's how I felt all my life. Like, that's how I felt all my life. Like, I was hard pressed to find a time that wasn't in restlessness and or irritability and or discontentedness, resentment that was already there, fear that was already there, real or things that were real or imagined, but they were in my head or they were in my spirit, all that stuff was already there. And so there was a sense of ease and comfort that it did come at once. Like I liked the way that it made me feel, what alcohol did for me, and of course I overshot the mark. I never made it through the whole movie because I had to keep going out to the bathroom throughout the film to throw up. So like the first time I drank, I got drunk. And every time I drank as a teenager, I didn't know that I was drinking. And I had I it was I didn't have control over how much I drank. Like I didn't know my drinking was alcoholic in definition, because everybody else that I hung out with as a teenager drank like that too. So the goal was to get the goal was never to socially drink when you're hanging out with these teenagers at keg parties or wherever you guys are hanging out. The goal was never to socially drink. Like the goal was always to like get messed up and go to oblivion. So I saw other people seemingly drink the way I was drinking. So it wasn't like it really stood out for me at that time. But when I went to go live on my own, I started college, and I had a full scholarship to a university. I had a full academic scholarship, and I had already been living a double life. I had started going to nightclubs when I was 16 years old. I had started hanging out with people in their 20s when I was in high school. I was starting to already have that double life on the weekends where, your parents think you're going and hanging out and spending the night with so and so, but you're doing a whole other thing, right? And so by the time I got to school, which I worked for the scholarship, it's another thing. This is just another example of how alcohol really started dictating the choices in my life, because I started at this university with a desire to do it. And I went through the first semester, did not have to pay for anything. And I went through the first semester and I dropped out after the first semester because it was getting in the way of drinking and going out to clubs and partying and like the lifestyle that was starting to happen around alcohol. And so my mind said, well, the thing that's got to go is this is school. So I squandered that scholarship, and my best thinking was to get a job at Burger King, working a double shift. It was a swing shift and an after-hours drive-through shift to save a whole bunch of money. And I got this apartment in this area out here in LA called Koreatown. And I got this little one room apartment that was over a liquor store. It was a bachelor apartment for $450 a month, believe it or not. But it was this bachelor apartment that was over a liquor store where the bed came out of the wall. And I had no furniture. The day I moved in, I found a white lawn chair on the side of the building. And I thought that was a God shot to me. Because I was like, oh, look, that was furniture, because I didn't have furniture. There was a woman selling pills in front of the building. So that just kind of shows you where I was. The day I moved in, someone tried to sell me loose pills in front of the apartment building I was moving into at 19 years old. So that kind of shows you like where I was kind of going in that moment. But I took my white lawn chair and got up there, got up to my apartment and had my, it was the TV stand slash guest chair. It played multiple roles, that chair. And I had a pantry of margarita mix and ramen noodles. And, I had a little office job making like, whatever minimum wage was. And I thought, I'm doing me. Like, that's what I thought. Like, I'm doing my life. And I'll tell you, the next 16, 15 years, I was 34 when I got sober. And I'll tell you, the next 15 years, that was emblematic of my best thinking as I just went through 15 years of a trial and error of my drinking escalating, my sense of restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness and dis-ease within myself, inescapable. And I did a lot of geographics. So I kept thinking, oh, I need to go to San Francisco. And then I'm going to arrange my life to look like this, and then I'll be okay. And then I'd go there and I'd burn my life to the ground in a matter of months. And I would never connect the dots of anything having to do with how I drank, my thinking, how I was living. I just thought it was people, it was circumstances, it was situations that were always kind of, conspiring against me. Or I was a nice guy, a lot of bad stuff happened to. I just was always at the wrong place at the wrong time. And I did that in a lot of places because I kept thinking this external thing I'm gonna find in this city or that city, I'm gonna get my life together. And it never happened. Or I would try something. I try church. I try a spiritual path. I chanted for a minute. I became a born again Christian for a minute. I tried this for a minute. I tried, and it was like I really thought I was giving these things a valiant effort, but I didn't really understand like A, what I was suffering from, and B, I really had no desire to live by spiritual principles, which I didn't even know what that was or use that language. I just was looking for something to be like a quick fix. Like, this is the thing that's going to make me feel okay. This is the thing that's going to fix me. And it never once crosses my mind, maybe there's a problem with how you're drinking and how you're living and how you're thinking. Like, that's never crossing my mind. So all I can do is try harder. I can just try harder. double down on my efforts, right? Redoubling my efforts. And so I just did that over the course of 15 years. And it was 15 years of being a tornado that was blowing through the lives of many people, family members, employers, romantic partners, and I put that in quotation marks, jobs, all kinds of, situations, roommates, just all kinds of situations. And my life just was, the bottom just kept falling out more and more and more. One thing that was a turning point, the last geographic I did was in New York City, and I left New York 3 years before I got sober because I always say I went for Sex in the City and got NYPD blue. And so I had to leave. And so, I came back to LA, and I noticed what I started noticing was, and this had probably happened, by the time I noticed that I've crossed an invisible line, by the time I have passed through a stage where there's no return through human aid, by the time I get there, and by the time I realize that it has probably happened a long time before then, I'm always the last one to know. And so I started noticing about 3 years before I got sober, something bad always happened every time I drank. And so then began me trying to manage it, control it, not drink in this situation or that situation. And I thought, and I couldn't, so it was mistakenly to me, I thought I was dealing with a willpower issue. And so I was failing at that, but I just kept thinking, oh, I can't do this, I can't do that. I'm not going to drink in this situation. It wasn't working. And, by the time I called my sister on Sunday, March 12th, you guys, and told her I found that number to that treatment center, I had a mind that was compromised, a physical health that was compromised. Like I was drinking myself to death. And I had wanted to stop. There's no more greater nightmare than when you want to stop and you can't. And I really tried everything I could come up with, and nothing was working. And when I went to that treatment center, resigned that I thought, okay, here I am. I guess now I'm appearing in institutions now. I'm a cliche, a 34-year-old guy in Hollywood and going to rehab. I had no idea what I was going to hear on that H&I panel that night from that woman was going to change my life. That I had no idea. Like that was just my moment. That was just like my moment of clarity. One thing led to the next, that led to the treatment center, that led to the H&I panel. I just had that desperation and that willingness, and I did whatever those people told me to do. And my sponsor, my very first sponsor, who lived in that area and sponsored a number of people in that treatment center, because we had like public meeting, we had a public meeting room at the treatment center. My first sponsor just gave me like a meeting directory. I did whatever. I didn't even know this man. I did not know this man. And I borrowed change from people every day because he told me to call him at 6 a.m. and I didn't have any money, but I borrowed change from people in that treatment center to make that 6 a.m. call every single day. And when I got out, he told me, you're going to go to this kind of meeting or go to this many meetings a week, you're going to go that many, and why I said yes to someone I didn't know when I never listened to anybody was just at the time, I just thought like, I didn't know there was another option. I didn't know I could say no. Like I didn't know that I couldn't not do it. Like I thought they said this, and they said, ask that man to be your sponsor. So I did. Like I didn't know saying no was an option. And so I just did everything that that man told me to do. And my first 2 years of sobriety was just all I did was I went to a meeting in a morning, a work during the day, a meeting at night, and I paid money back. That's all I did because people, I owed so much money, and people didn't want to wait till I got to the ninth step to get their money. Like people wanted their money. And so that's all I was doing was going to work, going to meeting in the morning, going to work during the day, meeting at night, and paying money back. And taking the bus to meetings because the car was still broken down, just whatever I needed to do. I'll tell you guys this. When I was 6 months sober, there was a meeting I used to walk to that was my home group at the time. And I'll never forget when I was leaving that meeting one day at 6 months of sobriety, my life on paper looked bad. If anyone was going to read my life on paper at 6 months of sobriety, I was 35 then. They would say, "Oh, this guy is a loser." I walked home from that meeting at 6 months of sobriety, like any other Tuesday night, and suddenly my eyes welled with tears, and I was overcome with emotion, and I realized for the first time in my life I was happy. For the first time in my life, I felt like I had joy. And what this was the thing that actually started really in my own living experience in real time was helping me tap into the idea of a power greater than myself. Because you hear people talk about it, but you need to have that moment in your own sobriety where that clicks for you. And that clicked for me then because I saw for the very first time in my life, I did not have to arrange anything on the outside in order to be okay. On the inside, it was always, when I get here, I'll be okay. When I get that, I'll be okay. When these situations come together like this, I'll be okay. And what I found out in that moment when I was walking home from that meeting is that for a life that looked really bad on paper, something was happening to me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that was transformational on a deep level. That was changing my life from the inside out in a way that was incomprehensible to me, that I couldn't put my finger on, but I knew was true because my very life was the living proof of it, as I was just doing the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And, from there began a muscle of building, because it was the believing in maybe there's something other than me, greater than me. I can have some faith, and my faith doesn't just have to be in my mind and my best thinking. Like, my faith really can be in something greater than me, not me at the time. I just thought, well, it's not me. That was enough for me to make my beginning, but my own life had to be the proof that that was true. It was of my own understanding. Somebody else would say, "Oh, you just were walking down the street that night." It was a way that a God of my own under disclosed itself to me in a way that was simple and made sense to me as I experienced it. It was of my own understanding. From that point, eventually I paid all the money back, you guys. I paid the money back. I made amends to people that said they never want to see me again. I went to employers. I had just incredible amends experiences. I went to employers that I made amends to. Some of them I had to pay money back to. And you know what they said? They said to me, "I knew something was wrong. I just didn't know what it was. I always liked you, Frederick. I always thought you were so great, but I just didn't know what was wrong. I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what I could do. I'm so glad you've come back to tell me this and you're doing well today." I had multiple conversations like that with people, with friends, stores I shoplifted from, and had to suffer the embarrassment of standing at manager's desk in the kiosk in the store to say, "I stole this thing that was $5 10 years ago. I'm here to pay it back." And, standing while they're snickering and laughing at you. They're snickering and laughing at you. But you know what? For me, I was like, I want to be free. I want to live. I want to be free. So I was like, I'm not, I don't want, like, if you're telling me that if I just do this stuff, that I really honestly can have a new life and a new freedom, like, that is what I wanted. And so, it wasn't that embarrassing when I was, just falling out drunk in the street or picking up cigarette butts off the ground at 3 o'clock in the morning, walking up down the street. But it was embarrassing to go back to that store to admit I'd stolen something 10 years before that was $5. Right. So, in this, essentially, the point I'm making is that in this 12-step process, like, my life transformed. People in AA, by example, were showing me how to live sober and just pointing me in the direction of a way of life and living where I could have a God of my own understanding that could be a power that I could actually believe in and follow the dictates of and get results in my life, which was so hard to believe because it was always kind of like, I don't know, God is great, but is God really going to figure all this out? I understood that I was powerless. Lack of power was my dilemma. I'm a person with a power shortage. In and of myself, I hit a glass ceiling in my own life. I can't get myself to the finish line in my own life because I just don't have enough power to get there. So I simply just needed more power, and I didn't have to call that anything when I understood that I was willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Maybe I didn't even have a name for it at that time, right? But I understood that because of my first step, why I needed to have a second step, and then I saw that, I needed to turn my will and my life over to, I needed a new manager that, Frederick Johnson Incorporated had just kind of went bankrupt. I kind of ran that company into the ground. We needed a business that was under new management, right? The inventory changed my life because, like I said, I got here and I thought I was the nicest guy in the world that would give you the shirt off my back. I had no idea the level of the tornado that I was, So I really got to see what my alcoholism looked like. I mean, all that inventory was just example after example after example after example of what it looks like to live a life powerless over alcohol, a life that's unmanageable, and a life with no God. Even when I was running around thinking I was some spiritual so-and-so before I got sober because of all the things I tried, And the first person I was ever completely honest with about any of that stuff was a sponsor in a fifth step, which radically changed my life to be able to have that kind of transparency with someone. So anyhow, I know I'm running out of time. I'll just say after being able to make those amends and really kind of get clean in my life, like I felt like I got a clean slate. And I got a clean slate to really be able to do. I remember I told someone in my home group when I made my last amends, and I ran up to her, this woman, this old timer, and I said, "I finished my amends. I finished my amends." And she goes, "Oh, great. Now the real work begins." And I was like so offended because I was like, "But I wrote all that inventory and I met all those people and I paid all that money back." And basically, what she was helping me understand that I've come to understand over these last 18 years of sobriety is that the first nine steps is really just getting me to a point so I actually can really just live. You know what I mean? Like I'm just the first nine steps is just establishing what I want to maintain and grow in my life. And I can't do that if I'm blocked. I can't do that, if I'm asleep and in the dark, And steps 10 and 11 and 12 keep the lights on. They keep me awake. They keep me in purpose. They keep me in service. They keep me, exactly where I need to be able to maintain what the first nine steps led me to. So I'll just say this, in these 18 years, I've had different sponsors. I've gone through the steps several times and had, even if I didn't have a lot of resentment, even if my fourth step was short, it was still nonetheless powerful. I always say you don't need a lot of resentment to be spiritually sick. When the lights go out, the lights go out. If I'm in the dark, I'm in the dark, and that could just be over a little bit of resentment, So, I just do the same thing today. It's interesting. I feel like my AA program or AA way of life is really kind of back to the simplicity that it was in the beginning 18 years ago. Like it's just, I went through all the things and did all the workshops and did all the stuff. And now it really just is the simplicity of I have a sponsor, I sponsor people that I take through the steps. I go to meetings, I participate in those meetings, and have commitments and participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I'm just living the life that A's and God has given me as a result. And all you guys told me to do is just show somebody else how to do it. That's all. I didn't have to, and I didn't even have to spend a dollar. I didn't have to spend a dollar. It was even that was suggested. So thank you for my life. Thank you guys for letting me share. And Donnie, thank you so much for asking me.